Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Adrian Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Well, hello, friends.
Brian Brushwood.
Well, howdy.
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, that's me.
Hey, gentlemen, did you get the news? Did you get the news?
No, that he is risen.
You know what? Kind of close to it. Apparently, somebody at NASA saw Infinity War and got really, really, really angry at Thanos and didn't make it to the theaters to see Endgame.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what? Where is this going, Andrew? We're going to Titan.
Wait, NASA is?
NASA's sending a probe to Titan. They want to send a hover, like a drone-like probe, to fly around and examine the surface of Titan with a nuclear-powered quadcopter.
So Titan has incredible air density, right? Like air pressure is almost like Earth. So mm-hmm. just a couple of propellers should be just fine. And yeah, it's mm-hmm. all methane, but there's no oxygen to make an explosion with. So basically just flying around in a methane atmosphere, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm. So there's some concept illustrations there, but it's a really cool mission because Titan is fascinating. Titan's got this, you know, this icy surface, but probably has a big, thick ocean below it. And if we're looking for places in the solar system where you could find life.
Well, I thought they had full-on rain. They had methane rain, like makes methane clouds in the methane clouds.
Rain. They got pools of hydrocarbons. I mean, lakes. It's like
yeah, that's the crazy part. You look at the what few photographs we have of Titan, and it definitely looks just straight up like Earth riverbeds and valleys and all that stuff.
But very yellow. Looks like Beijing. Actually, now I think about it.
Yeah.
Bryce, if you pull up the list of the instruments there you had before, we can see what's going to be on board there.
So the spacecraft is about 450 kilograms. It includes a mass spectrometer, a gamma ray and neutron spectrometer, a geophysics and meteorology package, and a camera suite, including microscopic and panoramic cameras.
So pretty cool. So this thing will apparently be able to like fly around. I don't know, I believe it will.
How long do they think it'll go for?
I think a couple of years. It's got that nuclear battery, so I think it's going to pick up, go from location to location, and land, and then take instruments and pick up. And it's just a great way, you know, with Mars, because we actually have a Mars helicopter in development. Because paradoxically, as it sounds, that because there's thin air, you'd think that like propellers and stuff wouldn't work, but because there's little air resistance, they have to go much, much faster. But you could get certain things that, you know, that you wouldn't likely think would work to work there because the thin atmosphere with the lower gravity on Mars makes that possible. And here on Titan, as you pointed out, Brian, with that thick atmosphere, comparatively so, you know, to get the surface of Titan, if you had like a breathing mask and maybe like kind of just a chemical suit, you could probably, the air pressure would be fine. You could probably walk around.
Wow.
Might be cold, but very exciting. Very exciting.
Yeah, well, and the idea of just like, you know, we're accustomed to probes moving at a couple miles an hour tops, but the idea that we could just fly around dynamically and just be like, yeah, go take a tour. And then just, I mean, can you think about the level of quality of video we're going to get? It's unprecedented. When this happens, we will have never seen anything like it before.
Yeah. There's a video, I just see, you do Titan mission as a search, you can see there's a concept video showing the rotorcraft landing and popping around there. The plan is to launch this thing somewhere between 2020 and 2029, that's proposed, and then orbital insertion between 2029 and 2038.
Okay, yeah, so 38 would be dependent on it not taking off.
2038, it can come and, you know, Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk's colony can wave to it as it lands.
Yeah.
We're watching this thing, the simulation of this thing flying across the you know, the Titan, and then it landing, and, you know, and it looks like the Sahara Desert right now. from the look of things. And
you know what's amazing is how normal that quadcopter design kind of looks now, in mm-hmm. a way that it probably would have looked very, very futuristic, not but like 10 years ago. But now there's so many commercial drones out there, and we're so used to what that looks like that that's like, oh, yeah, no, that makes all the sense in the world that that's the way that we go with it.
There's, you know, the thing, we get excited about some idea of the future, and then when we get it, we've had incremental versions of it. By the time we get it, we're like, oh, yeah, it's like when you, the iPhone's amazing, but you had Nokias and other cool smartphones that were part of the picture. You had going from the brick phone to the StarTAC, and then with the bigger display, you know, you're sort of prepped for these things. And with like quadcopters, like when we start seeing flying taxis, you know, using rotorcraft, or ones that might start using ducted fans that look like things out of Blade Runner, by the time we get to those, we're like, well, yeah, it's just a version of this.
Yeah.
It's just a version of that and a version of that.
It's just a quieter, more energy efficient version of this thing, that the solution that we've had and we've been iterating on for years and years and years.
Yeah. I mean, it's still, though, like, it's amazing to watch like a Harrier take off, a Harrier jet.
Oh, God, yeah.
You know. And that ultimately was a direction that we didn't pursue as much as vertical takeoff and landing. It wasn't because we didn't know how, it's just fuel efficiency. It was just so expensive to try to just take off without using aerodynamic lift.
Speaking of which, there was an article in The Economist talking about the possibility of not so much battery-powered aircraft, but hybrid aircraft. As I understand it, a turboprop airplane is basically a jet engine that spins a blade, and you can use the jet fuel to take off, but then once you take off, you don't need quite so much power, and so you can switch to sort of battery mode. And then when you come in for a landing, you actually, just like braking recharges your battery in your Prius, coming in for a landing, you would recharge the battery for your next takeoff, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, that's a lot of things going on there. But, you know, a modern hybrid car has a lot of things going on that 30 years ago, we'd be like, you know, like I had to rent a truck to go move a piece of equipment, and regular truck, but it had the engine that shut off at, you know, go to traffic lights. I mean, intentionally, not like my car in high school. And, you know, and I was thinking about, like, man, like, we've come so far with starters and stuff where it's, you know, we took hybrid technology and said, yeah, well, let's just have the engine, you know, just shut down when we get to a stop, if it stops for more than 10 seconds, because we'll save energy. Where 30 years ago, you wouldn't have done that because, like, the amount of energy to get it started again would have been, you know, a lot. But now the parts are smaller, things are more efficient. So,
yeah, the claim is 30% fuel savings. I think it does limit the passenger side. I think you can only get around 50 seats on it because of that type of technology. But, I mean, all that seems like a step in the right direction.
Yeah. Very cool. Sorry. It's yawning. We launched another Falcon Heavy last week, which is that's the SpaceX rocket where they take a Falcon 9 and they strap two other Falcon 9 rockets to it. And this was a very, very fast-paced, very high-powered takeoff. And they were able to – the first two boosters landed back at Cape Canaveral. The center booster had to go something like 2,000 miles out into the ocean and missed – coming in, it was coming in faster and hotter than they've ever had one come back in before. So it missed the barge by that much and went into the ocean. So it wasn't really like, a loss. It was more like, all right, we need to pay attention to that now. But what was cool was, remember how we talked about SpaceX was trying to capture the fairing? That's the big shell that goes over.
Yeah, the fairing, they had the crazy contract because basically just falls down. And you can't strap rockets to it. There's no fuel in it. You just gotta try to catch it. And so
They put a parasail on it, so it'll sort of guide itself a bit. And they've been sending out when they can launches one ship with basically a giant acrobatic net out there, and they've been trying for years to catch the fairings, just trying to catch one fairing, just proof of concept. Can we catch one? Because each one of those is worth like $3 million. Because the, you know, how big it is. So, and that's $6 million is over 10% now of the launch cost. They caught one. They caught half of a fairing.
So here's a weird question. let's project 10, 20, 30 years into the future where there are so many launches. Is there a point at which it no longer makes sense for SpaceX themselves to be taking on I'm wondering if there's a time where they just announce a schedule and privateers run around and just try to capture for bounties. Like, they're like, hey, man, we don't want to do all this ourselves. We'll pay $500,000 bounty to anyone who catches one. Here's our launch schedule. We're launching so many times. I guess there's never a point where that makes sense because it's always going to be cheaper once they perfect the technology for them to catch it themselves.
Well, and you don't want ships colliding with each other trying to get it. You have telemetry. You have all these other things going on. And you have proprietary technologies on board you don't want.
That, I guess.
Yes, Andrew, all of that is absolutely true. But what Brian is desperately trying to get to, no matter how thin the logic, is something I agree very deeply with, which is that just a wild, it's a mad, mad, mad world style people just semi-pirates collecting.
I mean, that's I think that would be a tremendous set piece for a movie, right? Like what a world right. where you got this kind of Mad Max and you know you're catching sky jewels basically.
Now maybe not SpaceX, right? But who knows? In some world where everything is so commoditized and there's a million different people kind of doing this, then who knows?
You could replace that scenario with some satellites. And this is one of the things that spy satellites would do is they would use back in the day before it was possible to do really good digital transmission of images is they would have canisters that would eject and a canister would go into the Earth's atmosphere. Right. And then it would have a little heat shield and small things. And they would have a parachute and they would try to capture it from midair with an airplane. Right. Because this is how they got, the film back from the spy satellites. I could see when you start getting a lot more satellites up there and whatnot that, if you want to do experiments and, oh, shoot, our thing just landed in the Congo. I need to hire a group of Austin Mavericks to go out there and capture this thing for us.
That's pretty good. I can also imagine.
We could use the cover of a podcast to do it.
I wonder if there could be a story where, just as. We did an episode that'll be coming up soon on the Modern Rogue about shortwave radio and how you have this finite resource in the bandwidth spectrum. And so there are certain areas that are carved out for special areas or special uses, but others that are kind of like a free for all. What if you had a story that took place in the far enough future that there essentially was the same story with orbits? Like there was a free for all orbit that was low enough that even if, your crap smashed into another crap, it would just immediately fall down and evaporate. But then maybe that's the story, is that all those people are spending money, not big money, but big enough that when their satellites go down, they're hardened enough that the data, the science, the experiment is still in there. And so you have wild bounty chasers running around trying to get the goods before the other guy. I don't know. There's something to that.
I'm sorry, Brian. I didn't hear you. I'm in the middle of writing my new novel, Star Chasers. Didn't hear any of what you said. Let's go to the next topic. We saw an American company which used an Indian satellite, Indian space agency to launch something against FCC recommendations and that. I think that the problem we have right now is that SpaceX has lowered the cost of launch, right? Like they look at the cost have gone down. Reusability is now factored into the price. Everybody else is scrambling, but it's not like industry has started to really catch on and say, man, we need to be doing more stuff in space. We need to be doing materials research. We should be doing this. It's like internet availability, in the early, the late 80s or, the World Wide Web in the early 90s. Like, oh, that's a cool thing. Maybe someday somebody will make use of it, and it's like, and 10 years, 15 years from now, you're going to look back and go, man, why don't we get into this sooner? But right now there's not enough people trying to do that at the time. It's smaller in startups. There are a lot of cool startups. So,
well, and I wonder how many people are already thinking 20 to 40 years ahead, like Netflix did. I mean, at a time that most people were on dial up Netflix, they didn't name their company DVDs by mail, even though that's what their actual product was. They named it Netflix because they knew even then the dream that they were aiming for. Eventually, bandwidth will be ubiquitous and fast. And when it does, we will be well positioned to take over all of the entertainment industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just comes down to how much money. The cool thing is between Firefly Systems and a lot of these other companies trying to develop cheaper launch systems is you can start to get more exploratory R&D budgets. Like you can't do a space mission right now. Most companies or pharmaceuticals couldn't do one with their regular a small part of their R&D budget, you know. But as these costs fall down to a couple $100,000 or a few $1 million to do this sort of stuff, you might see people thinking that more forward. You know, that's what's exciting, you know.
Yeah.
You know, this is exciting. It's keeping what? Us on the air.
Oh, hell yeah, Andrew. Patreon.com/weirdthings where you go if you're a Weird Things aficionado, a Weird Things fan, a Weird Things supporter, you want to keep this program rolling, then head on over there right now. Patreon.com/weirdthings. That's where you can kick us a little scratch, make sure that we keep rolling here on the show. And also you get our show After Things, which happens after Weird Things, a little earlier than everybody else. Folks, it keeps us doing this show. I'll tell you what, I blew out my voice over the weekend. In another world, would I say, hey, I should save my voice? Maybe, but not because, not when there's a patreon.com/weirdthings. Me and my little money-grubbing fingers needs to get every single penny I can. And I crawl out and croak my way through this episode for you folks. I'm glad you enjoy it. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
I sent a link over to Bryce. I'm going to ask you a question. So right now, if we wanted to take this show, this like an hour of audio, and compress it, about how, what would the file size be?
An hour of audio compressed, what, about 10 megabytes or so? 5 megabytes? It depends on the quality. If you just wanted to barely hear, I think we could get it down to 3 megabytes if you just needed like less than AM quality.
Bryce, what's your take on that?
I'm actually going to try to download one of our episodes here and see what it is. But we down convert to, I want to say 96 kilobit per second. Just because we sometimes can go up to like an hour and a half, so we get mm-hmm. it pretty small. For example, After Things last week, which I think was less than an hour, was 27 megabytes.
Yep. So and we're seeing here, like B5per says, that MP3 128 kilobits per second is about 1 meg per minute. And there's some better compression schemes out there, like Ogg has Opus and some of the variants on that, and some other stuff. So. Super, super heavily compressed, like Brian pointed out. Like, yeah, you start getting like 5 megabytes. What if we could have a really good quality version of this show, an hour that we could fit on one floppy disk?
One megabyte.
Wow.
A floppy disk, Bryce, used to be a form of storage.
I grew up with. I had the big floppy disk. I had the thing. You click it in, you lock it in. You could, if you
Bryce,
could remember
like,
how to play Jeopardy,
which my mom put under our soft drinks when we started trying to set them on the counter. how about 1 megabyte? Any takers?
I mean, that's extraordinary. What level of quality are we talking about?
Bryce, did you get the example I sent?
I do. This is the Codec 2.
So, pretty damn good quality is the answer, Brian. And the way the answer is because of machine learning and artificial intelligence. What some people have done is they've taken a standard Codec 2, which is a pretty good codec for for compressing audio like human speech. You compress it, and if you just listen to the Codec 2, you're like. So Brian Brushwood decided to look, and you're like, well, that sounds like old-timey radio and not that good.
Right.
But by then putting it through WaveNet, which is the same technology they use for speech synthesis and for artificial intelligence to figure out how to turn text into speech, it can take that in modifications, of course, they can take that and reconstruct it and fill in all those little bits of the human, basically. If you want to play some examples,
yeah. So here
won't sound like anything to our listeners.
So yeah, that's true. So we've got the original file here. This is a sample.
Separately, New York State sold about $77.1 million of certificates of participation.
Okay, so you can kind of hear it's a little. It almost sounds like it's already been compressed, and maybe it's not.
Yeah.
Perfect microphone. Here's Codec 2.
Separately, New York State sold about $77.1 million of certificates of participation.
So it's like speak and spell, basically.
Yeah, and that's super compressed version. And now they're going to use the WaveNet. They're going to take that actual file and use the WaveNet decoder.
Right. This is a decoder, not an encoder.
Yeah.
Separately, New York State sold about $77.1 million of certificates of participation.
Holy cow. And
it sounds cleaner.
You know what's amazing is I'll bet, imagine we get to a place where there's sort of a checksum for a person's cadence, voice, facial structure, and linguistic patterns. Then all you would need to do is send over that sort of checksum and then the actual text of it with time codes of which words are said when. And then all of a sudden you could get even smaller when a machine learning just says, do the Brian Brushwood voice, use the Brian Brushwood library. Imagine Brian Brushwood says this, and then it just ends up sounding exactly the same.
Well, yeah, here, remember with text, you might lose intonation and certain other things. But with like a version of this, though, you're getting so much data from there. Mm-hmm. Play the female voice, because I thought that was even better.
Sure.
The third version we hear is taking that second. It's the same audio as the second version and just going back and saying, this is how I think it's supposed to sound.
Sure. So here's the original female example.
Under terms previously reported, the Italian agricultural concern assumed about $195 million in subordinated debt as part of the transaction.
All right, here's the Codec 2 version.
Under terms previously reported, the Italian agricultural concern assumed about $195 million in subordinated debt as part of the transaction.
And with the WaveNet decoder.
Under terms previously reported, the Italian agricultural concern assumed about $195 million in subordinated debt as part of the transaction.
You know, this technology is amazing. I just personally wish they wouldn't have picked such racy examples for
them. So I have a question for you, Andrew. So the trade-off you have when you have higher compression, and you see this more in video because video has even higher bit rates and much more stringent compression, it requires a lot more processing power to decode it. And so with this WaveNet decoder, if it's so compressed here, and it sounds like the WaveNet decoder is actually synthesizing new data out of it, would this, like, what is it, something where you need a bunch of extra processing power to decode this?
It is going to be more processing power intensive than other codecs. And that's one of the things that we try to do with codecs now is we try to make them, you know, very efficient. Remember, our voices right now, everything we do across the internet involving voice, almost images and every video is compressed. And then with mobile, we've been putting this sort of like, we've got to make these things faster, yet not burn up a ton of energy. So that'll be the next phase, is to make them more efficient. But one of the beautiful things that happens with machine learning is that you eventually develop algorithms to get better and better at it. I think we talked about, or I don't know if we talked about this. Physicists have been using a machine learning system to recreate like the universe, you know, basically like the physics and the placement of things around there. And by machine learning, by putting in a bunch of inputs, this is what the data is. This is what this thing's usually end up looking like. Figure out the fastest way to process it. They developed a system that's far less processor intensive than conventional ways. So with machine learning codecs, and we'll get to me, and this isn't machine learning encoding, as you pointed out, Bryce, but when we start getting into the more advanced versions of that, they'll get efficient. And it's been pointed out in, the criticism pointed out in our chat room here is it's like, you know, this is for voice only. And that's true. Like if you tried to put, you know, a song through there, it'll sound like garbage. It's not what it's tuned for, but we've come a long way. Do you remember like the MP3 codec was created by a guy, you know, listening to Susan Vega's I'm Sitting in the Corner,
Tom
tweaking
Steiner?
The math by hand back and forth until he said, yep, good enough. And that became the standard for billions of downloads because one guy, you know, going over. So now that we're using AI and machine learning to do these things, expect to see really good ones for music and other stuff, and you know, extremely small, and you know, and it's not like we're sitting there going, oh yeah, because you know, transmitting voice is still a problem. But as you start to see things like Google Stadia, or you're playing video games and start to play VR and this stuff, and you want to compress and send really complicated experiences across the inner tubes, these will help.
Dude, that's remarkable. And it's interesting because in an age where bandwidth keeps getting faster and faster, We could afford to be a little bit bloated and just, you know, run stuff less and less compressed. But I wonder if, you know, as Moore's Law is not going to stop and all of a sudden processing power just gets stronger and stronger in your phone, it's going to be like it's going to be faster and faster. There's a device called we've talked about it before, called a Winston, that basically acts as a relaying bridge between your router and your cable modem. And by virtue of cutting out so much of the advertising stuff, websites, even though it's technically slower because it takes more hops and processing time, it cuts out so much of the advertising and tracking garbage that websites allegedly actually load even faster. And so, you know, up to 30% faster. So if this is the case, we could do the same thing with a bunch of other data points over mobile. It seems like a great idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's is where... You know, the thing that struck me about the Google doing their Stadia, which is, for those of you who don't know, that's their video game platform coming out, where basically they're going to stream the video game system itself. The console will be a Google server somewhere sending you the video, and then your controller is going to be sending your position, you know, what you're moving back and forth to at your position, stuff like this. And I think I think certain things are happening locally, but the real thing's happening remotely. But, like, you know, when you want to get into 4K, 8K games and you know, super high res VR and stuff like this, and you want to do that remotely on a cloud server, that's a lot of bandwidth.
Yeah, but, you're not kidding.
You know, these compression things make that easier. So it's a very, very, very interesting future. I've been listening to an audiobook, which will probably be my pick when I finish it, but is the How the Internet Happened. And it really, really great overview of a lot of things. You know, to basically, you know, from Netscape to Napster to Netflix. Well, I mean, other things that don't begin with N, but it's a very, very wide, you know, story of, like, the technologies that, you know, made things happen, and a lot of things that, you know, stories is sort of like forgot. But, like, you know, last night, Brian, they were talking about the whole, you know, Reed Hastings, like, well, we didn't call it Netflix because it was DVDs by mail, you know, and cool stories. I got one more cool story for you here. And this is another, again, it's a little bit machine learning, you know, heavy today, but there's just so much stuff happening in this world of, you know, developments happening at a pretty rapid pace. Like, last week there were several stories, like Facebook improved the algorithms they were using to reconstruct your face. So when you have virtual avatars, which that looked really cool. But this was one that I thought was kind of the neatest one, other than that voice compression thing, which I thought was a pretty cool, is we've talked about GANs before. Those are what we call generative adversarial networks, where basically one algorithm, one system is saying, I can detect faces, and the other algorithm saying, like, I can generate random noise but learn to make faces and test me. And they test each other until the face generator gets really good at making faces. It can fool the face detection system or anything else you want to do. Microsoft unveiled a new system, or revealed researchers at Microsoft and JD AI Labs, object-driven attention generative adversarial networks, you know, that one. And what it is they took a system, remember how they could, like, you know, take photos and say, hey, this is like a dog catching a frisbee, right? And it would, you look at the photo and identify that. Now they've done it in reverse.
Now you just say, show me a dog throwing biting a frisbee.
And it generates, you know, you could say dog catching, you know, a cat in midair. It's never seen that thing happen before, yet it figures out this is what this should probably look like. And it can do pretty cool job of generating these images.
Man, wasn't there another thing like 6-8 months ago where you could just type in, show me a picture of this person and this person, or this person with this other person's face? I'm sure
possibly
there was one of the listeners.
I know that they had a chat bot where you could ask it to generate
the drawing.
You know, it would do Google image searches and combine stuff.
I know what you're talking about. I don't know if we covered it on this purpose.
Yeah, it was pretty lo-fi, but this looks like it's just more of a procedurally generated sandbox world of whatever you can cook up. It'll send you a picture of.
Mm-hmm. And these you know, aren't like the most. You look at these, you're like, yeah, I kind of get what it's saying. But again, these things get better and better and better. And then you start training the data sets. Like, I think I'd love for somebody to train this with a comic book data set, you know, Batman, you know, punching Penguin, whatever, you know, cross boundaries, you know. You know, Batman and Iron Man drinking a beer, you know, and we're going to get that. That's the kind of thing that's fascinating, is that the things that you can imagine, AI is going to get very good. It'll be like having an artist as your best friend that's willing to draw all those cool comics you wanted in school, or create movies and experiences.
That's so crazy.
Yeah. When it picks.
Yeah. I'm not late to the party. You're late to the party. I know this is a bold stance, but I think Documentary Now season 3 is much better than season 2. It's getting caught up on that. I have a few more to go in season 3, but man, season 2 was really a slog. Like, at some point they just a lot of them felt like, once I got the joke, I was like, well, I don't think it's going to make me laugh, so I would skip the last 20 minutes of some of them just to go on to the next one. But whereas everything I'm seeing in season 3 is they really have bothered to write jokes in there outside of, isn't this exactly like the thing we're copying?
Yeah, I think it's that show at its best has always been great at not only making it a funny journey, but also that you kind of care about the story within it, and that the story within it is well told. There's always something else going on that you are kind of following, and it's not just like, well, if you loved this documentary, like, wait for our Spaceballs version. I think that's a huge part of season 3, that like every single one of the episodes has its own little, except for maybe the Rent one, but even then, the funny part of that is that they're singing these songs for a musical that doesn't exist.
Well, and in that case, it's like, it's so outrageous, and I don't want to say bad, but just like it's got that amazing, like, wow, these are really talented songwriters writing about a really, you know, low rent version of an established property. And they just bake that into all of the lines, and so it was a real delight to watch. I never saw the Finding the Calvin and Hobbes guy, Finding Mr. Watterson. So the parody of Finding Gary Larson, it seemed like it was kind of a scathing indictment of the Finding Mr. Watterson, where they're kind of saying that the filmmaker is a piece of garbage, if they're directly doing that.
I'm with you. I haven't seen that doc, but either that was their own commentary on just where we are in terms of documentaries. It's either a scathing indictment on that concept, or it's a scathing indictment on that person.
Exactly.
I'm unqualified to weigh an opinion either, but I remember watching like the trailer for the one there, because they were trying to make one about trying to find Chris Columbus. John Hughes, you know, the guy that worked with John Hughes. There was one about trying to find John Hughes, and the trailer, you watch part of it, and it was like, it felt like they were owed. We were owed this explanation of what happened to this man who disappeared from public life, and we want to go try and find him. And it's like, no, you're not.
Yeah.
You're not owed an explanation. You can make a documentary about his work and whatnot, and not insert yourselves in there, you know, maybe maligning the whole thing. But I remember watching the trailer and being turned off by the concept, because it's like, this I deserve to know because my personal journey is so important, you know, and that's what this was really a great indictment of, is these documentaries where, you know, people want to show their own importance. You know, and it's the frustrated filmmaker who finally figures out, like, well, I'm going to become the center of, you know, something by putting myself there, says a guy who may or may not have a documentary coming out very soon about himself.
I will say that, man, they front loaded the badass on season 3 with Backcrap Valley parts 1 and 2. And especially when it took me longer than I'd like to admit to realize that that's Owen Wilson as the guru. It's pretty great.
Yeah, no, I was definitely, it took me a little bit to, I'm like, I know he's someone. Who is? And then as soon as they had like that first like thing with the nose, and I'm like, oh my God, that's brilliant.
Yeah. That one was like, that was too long for me compared to the others, but still,
I don't know, splitting it into two parts, because it's one story and then a big twist at the end, and then it becomes a second story with more context.
I liked it better than I liked their other two-parters. I think that their other two-parters tend to be like, oh, no, we just have a really great thing, and we're gonna split it into two halves, like the Blue Gene Committee one, where it's like that Blue Gene Committee one probably could have been a better one episode thing than it was a two episode. At least with Batcrap Valley, it was there was like this very, you know, the new characters that were heretofore unintroduced, like Michael Keaton carries the second one.
Also, Fred Armiston, that dude could speak Spanish, and he could do accents that good enough to fool the bit. He passed the Turing test on this guy.
Yeah,
that's kind of been his bit though forever. Is the like you know even going back to like Euro Trip, like he just loves playing people who speak other languages speaking English. Like
I'm thinking about the whoever Juan Likes Rice and Chicken, where he just does the whole thing in Spanish, and it sounds to me as passable and authentic as I'm able to discern.
He's a great mimic. He's awesome, and I think he's really strong in this this season.
Yeah, I met him at a party once. It was after season one, and he was just standing there by himself. I'm like, hey, I don't want to be weird, I don't want to annoy you, but like, Documentary Now is amazing. It's one of my favorite things you've done. I'm sorry, and I'm like so appalled. He's like, oh, that's great. No, I like to hear that. It's really cool, you know. And I'm like, yeah. And then that awkward silence where I'm like, well, I said the thing I wanted to say. Nobody else is here talking to him. I don't want to just turn around and walk away like, hey, I got better things to do. But, you know, you never think about that when you're like, oh, I'm going to go talk to this person. I'm like, how am I going to get out of talking to that person?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's always the move to punch out. And then if they are like reaching, if you're like, anyway, man, I just wanted to say that. If then there's another like, oh, really? What was your favorite episode? Then it's like, okay, well, now we're talking. We have like consent conversation. But if it's just like the roll up, then it's like, hey, man, good job by you. Here I go. Anyway,
it's a very small party. So it's like, I'm just going to go stand over here by myself. Yeah. And we'll
that's a rough one. That's a high degree of difficulty.
Yeah.
Especially since he's kind of famously sort of anxious anyway. Like I had this, I've been doing this thing on the Jury Daily podcast where I've just been asking people like, all right, if you had like a celebrity, there's like a few celebrities that have kind of like, they're like their own lifestyle brands. Like that you like, that you just find them fascinating as people and you would like want them to just be somebody that would like text you every 3 weeks and be like, hey, I'm doing blank, whatever that blank might be. I had like, you know, Bill Murray is that for a certain demographic. Jeff Goldblum is that for a certain demographic. There's these people that kind of radiate like a lifestyle. And a bunch of people started writing in about their favorite things, but they were all like people that are famously anxious. And it's like, no, you wouldn't want to hang out with that person. Like you'd want to watch their work, but you wouldn't hang out. Like that's, you know, I don't know. That's super weird.
Yeah. That's the expression. Like you don't want to meet your heroes.
There, and then there's that, yeah, is that anybody, even the people that we might think are like, oh, wow, it'd be really cool to, like, go to one, you know, I wonder what, like, underground art museum that I would, if I was hanging out with Jeff Goldblum, he would, that we would go see. And then it's like, no, everyone's probably weird.
Yeah, I don't know about him, but, like, yeah, sometimes I want to meet so-and-so, and it's like, you don't. You know, it's like, you don't. Brian Brushwood is the worst. You hold on. Hey, I'm good to meet you, Brian. He holds on to your hand. He doesn't let go. He's like, how are you? Have you seen all the episodes of Modern Rogue? Have you?
What about before that? Did you see the precursor, Brian Rushwood on the Road? Did you ever watch any of my old stage show? I did a lecture in 2006.
You ever been to Halloween Horror Nights?
So there's maybe it's not for here, but there's a, there was a story about a Hollywood celebrity that, like, you know, you go to, he invites people to his house, go over to his house, and he'll, like, play, like, his old movies and stuff for you, you know? And, like, I had that experience of, like, somebody, like, oh, you come hang out, come over, hang out. And it's like, oh, yeah, we're going to watch this thing. And I'm like, wow, that's a thing people really do? Yeah, no, guys, you should come drop by. I'm going to, you know, play some of my old, you know, clips and stuff. It'll be cool. Be great.
Yeah, man, I'll tell you what. I really don't have a great pick because I've been so drilled in on the debates that happened in the live show.
I know your pick. I know your pick. Your pick is your upcoming appearance on a friend of our show.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I wish I knew how to promote it. But there is the great and powerful Andrew Heaton, who previously was doing a show called Something's Off with Andrew Heaton. And I can neither confirm nor deny that tomorrow, one Brian Brushwood and myself will be recording something with Andrew Heaton. And that may or may not be the first episode of the new chapter of his podcasting career. So I guess, Bryce, what is his Patreon / Andrew Heaton?
Yes.
Andrew Heaton on Patreon.
Yeah. Patreon.com/ Andrew Heaton. Go ahead and get in on it.
Very cool. Bryce?
Yeah, I got a pick. So over the weekend, a new video game came out, and it was very cool. It was interesting because I think it's a very novel game, but it's also a sequel to an existing game. It's Super Mario Maker 2. I don't know if you guys have any seen anything about this.
I mean, yeah, I assume you make Mario levels and you can get wacky and creative with it.
Yeah, pretty much. They added a lot of new stuff to this game, so they added new like background sets. They added night mode. So for example, like on the in the sky, there's like a sky backdrop, you know, the clouds version. In the night mode, it's low gravity. Or in there's like a I think it's in the underground cave, gravity is upside down. So there are like new twists on the types of levels you can make. They added a bunch of new objects. It's very cool. And I think even if you're not interested in the actual like making levels, there's already thousands and thousands of really cool levels that people have made. It also has a story mode. So you can the Peach's castle gets exploded and you have to collect coins by doing jobs to have the Toads rebuild it. It's cool. I don't know. I think it's a lot of fun. I've made a few levels already and it's...
Yeah, didn't you like make a level where Mario goes like and collects unemployment insurance or something?
I made a new level where Mario goes to the movies. And so you go into town and you go into a movie theater and you find your right theater. And it's fun. It's a very simple like idea, but it lets you do wacky, crazy stuff like that. Having all the tools at your fingertips, it makes it easy to like, oh, well, you know, I can add this or I can do this and move this around. So I think if you have a Switch, it was one of the best games for the Wii U when the first one came out a few years ago. And I think this one is a very solid follow-up. It's a worthy sequel to that. So
I wonder how long until people just make their ports of like unauthorized like other movies like Reality Bites but it's Mario.
This is a little bit of a tangent, but have you guys seen the game Dreams on PS4?
Mm-mm.
Dreams is a very similar thing. It's from the same people who made Little Big Planet, but it's kind of a similar sort of user creation game where you can make levels. But their whole thing is very in-depth, and you can make literally any type of game within it. People have gone through and made, I don't know if it was in Dreams or in Little Big Planet 3, but someone has already gone in and made Super Mario Maker in this Maker
game.
Wow.
That's crazy.
So user-generated content as a platform is very cool, and I think the Super Mario Maker one is very accessible to get into.
As B-Fifer points out in our chat room, is that it's Turing complete, and that means that basically any Turing machine is a computer that can do basically a certain number of logical functions. Mm-hmm. Every computer we use is pretty much Turing complete, and you can simulate another computer on it, which means that be slower, but you could theoretically run Windows on a Turing complete system. It might just take you 1,000 years to get through the startup sequence.
Yeah.
Mario Maker 2 is Turing complete. You could use it to simulate any other computer system.
Yeah.
Wow.
Magic the Gathering is actually Turing complete as far as the card play.
How so?
Or as far as this does this, then it does that.
Right.
Or,
just because it is a system.
Yeah. If you can make infinite customizable cards, you can design a version that because each one is a cycle that interacts with itself.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah. Wow, that's a really clever parallel that I wouldn't have thought of. That's amazing.
Wow. Yeah.
I'm going to do two picks. Quick pick one is I've been playing my Oculus Quest, still loving it, which, you know, for me is, you know, to have this much of attention span for anything is surprising. The latest game I've been having a lot of fun with is Moss, which is on other platforms too. It's where you control a little mouse running through this sort of fantasy forest environment, solving puzzles and stuff. And what's cool about this is it's instead of you doing first person as the mouse, it's like a conventional sort of game where you're controlling, you know, the character running around. But because it's in 3D virtual reality, you're looking at these dioramas and sort of leaning in and helping her, you know, jump over, navigate things and solve problems. And the gameplay, I'm several hours into it. It's been a lot of fun. You know, I'm not like a run around and shoot at things kind of I have Space Pirate Trainer, which is cool, but I'm like, all right, I'm bored. Where this is sort of fun and engaging, and the graphics, you know, on the Quest, you know, they're not as detailed as you're going to get on the PC version, but are really amazing. And it's neat because you look at this sort of like, you know, she enters this sort of like underground cavern with, you know, vines and stone structures and stuff like this. And then you just lean your head into the scene and you can look all around and go, oh, there's the scroll I need to find. So, Moss is a fun game. I know it's on the Quest. I think it's probably available on, you know, probably on Vive too, and probably the Rift, et cetera. So
yeah. Nice.
Cool. My other pick is, when it comes to crazy personalities and you hear that they're making like, oh, they're going to do a TV show or a movie about some people, you go like, oh, they're going to have to make up a bunch of stuff to make it interesting. Sometimes you hear that about somebody, you go like, oh man, I hope they have enough time to tell everything about this person because they're so weird. Strange Angel, the story of Jack Parsons. Jack Parsons is the pioneering rocket chemist who helped develop a lot of the technologies that went to go into the American, you know, basically space program. He got his start in the 1930s working with some other people at Caltech. He wasn't actually a Caltech scientist. He was a hobbyist chemist and loved to make things explode. Eventually, the Caltech said, you know what? We probably can't have you guys on campus. We're going to move you off location to some other place. And that became JPL. JPL Laboratory is actually the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. May have got the initials JP from Jack Parsons because he is that kind of guy. Of course, like, oh, that's fascinating. Like, oh, yeah, he was also an occultist into Satan worship, used to live with L. Ron Hubbard, and was into some very, very weird stuff.
That's amazing. You
know, yeah. Follower of Aleister Crowley. The series is based loosely on the book Strange Angel. They incorporate, you know, understand, 1930s was a big time for science fiction stuff, and this is a guy who is prone to sort of flights of fancy and imagination, and I think they do a wonderful job of doing this. The series opens them up with basically you're watching a scene from some pulp magazine that he's reading, and it's not forced to me. You know, like there's another episode where H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds is playing, and he periodically, when he comes to a setback, sort of stops to imagine the tripods blowing stuff up. And it's not like a Walter Mitty. It's just to show you this guy's got one, his mind is half in the future in the world of fantasy because of the world he wants to make. You know, he wants to build rockets because he wants us to go to the moon, you know. So, Strange Angel. It's on CBS All Access.
Right on.
Dope.
All right, everybody. It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.